I like to tell people I was raised in a beauty salon, and it's somewhat true. After I went to school each day, if I did not have practice for a sport, I was at my mother's beauty salon. Think about the polarized childhood I had. A locker room, a weight room, a football field, or a beauty salon. If you ever wonder why I am the way I am, I've just explained it right there. I would go to my mom's salon, and it was a part of my job. I think parents are always wise to think of ways they can give their kids opportunities to learn, to grow, and serve, and work in some way, and it was a part of my routine of life. I would go and work at my mother's beauty salon. And you can learn so much. There's a whole curriculum that happens at a beauty salon. I'm telling you, you can learn so, so much. Part of my job was to clean up, so I would clean the combs and brushes. I would clean other instruments. I would sweep up hair. I would vacuum, take out trash, these basic kinds of activities. My mother owned this salon with her sister. This is a family business. And so I grew up in a family business environment. And my mother and her sister employed a few different folks, some part-time, some full-time over the years. And a couple of those employees stood out to me. One, my mother and her sister are believers, and they ran their business just as very best that they could as a Christian business. They tried to honor Christ by putting out Bibles and devotional books. They would regularly pray. If a woman had a need, they did so much counseling. I think my mom has a degree in counseling without ever going to school. And trying to help people, they would be servants. They would talk about their own testimonies. They would give financially off of the profits of the business, so the business would give to the church as well as them individually. It was just part of what they were doing. But that their business mindset extended to their employees, and one of those employees, and this was occasionally the case, someone would have needs, and my mom, my aunt would try to help them out. And this woman who worked for them for a time had claimed to be a believer, and she had kind of association with a local church that they knew of, and she needed a job and was kind of down and out, and so my mom and aunt extended a job to her. And so in this salon, there are four chairs, so she had a chair that was hers to work at, and the responsibilities to keep the area clean, be ready for the next customer and so forth. And it soon became apparent that she did not have a Christian work ethic. She would come, and she would kind of be there, and then she would do a lot of sitting in that chair. And other people are supposed to sit in that chair, and she's supposed to stand behind them doing their hair so that that person can have a good experience at the business and pay so that everybody makes money, so everybody eats. And she wasn't real aggressive in that sense. And she would sometimes make come on. My mom said, "You need to get this cleaned up. I have my next customer's not for an hour." But my mom and my aunt wanted to be ready for walk-ins, because if someone just walked in, they wanted to be ready to accommodate that person so they could give that person a good experience at the business and make money. That's why we are here. And it became apparent over time that this employee was milking my mom and my aunt. And I could tell this as a junior hire. And I heard about it at home. This is not a good situation. And my mom and my aunt's generosity was being taken advantage of. And they were gracious. They tried to put structures into place to help her, but they had to just let her go, and she was ready to, because she wanted to sit more than actually contribute. And even though my parents were believers, and she claimed to be a believer, they still had to let her go because she wasn't doing what she needed to do. She was, in some ways, even taking advantage of my mom and my aunt because they were believers. As if, well, you're a Christian, you shouldn't actually make me work here. You should, come on, you should just take care of me along the way. There's another employee that is remarkable in my mind as I think back. And this employee didn't start working for my mom and my aunt until I was out of the home. I was here in Kansas City. It was around 2010 or so. And she began to work there part-time. When she began to work for my mom, the atmosphere of the business changed. She was aggressive. She did excellent work. She was hardworking. She, too, was a Christian. She claimed it, and she attended a local church. My mom and my aunt knew, and the environment of the business changed when she began to work there. She would do a good job, and afterwards she would clean up to be ready for any walk-ins, which over time she didn't have many because her schedule was so full. She couldn't accommodate walk-ins because so many people were making appointments with her. She would help out with others. She would ask my mom what was the next thing I could do. She would volunteer to clean up other areas. She did a great job as a Christian employee. She was a part-time employee at first, but as a part-time employee, it was as if the org chart of this small business was inverted. Because when she showed up, she had so much enthusiasm, the whole atmosphere changed. My mom's job got easier. She didn't have to worry so much about just keeping the atmosphere going because this gal jumped right in. And I would call and talk. Julie would call and say, things are good here at work. This morning, I want to think with you from 1 Timothy 6 about money and spirituality. And the link between those two ideas is work. It's work. It's how we work. It's why we work. It's our attitude about work. And it's a spiritual expression in Paul's mind. We are here in 1 Timothy 6, if you're a guest with us. And Paul, in chapters 5 and 6, is dealing with classes of people in the local church and how they should behave as God's household. Turn with me to 1 Timothy. If you're holding a printed Bible, it's toward the end, about 90% of the way through a printed Bible. Locate with me 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy 3 is where I want to begin. In verse 14, 1 Timothy 3, 14 to 16, Paul, I think, sets out his rationale for writing. He expresses that in so many words. And his concern is for the church's beliefs and behavior, that those two ideas go together. That in the Christian message, you may be newer to Christianity or a young person learning about Christianity. This is important for you to understand. What Christians believe is made visible in how they behave. There's a relationship between what we believe and how we behave. We believe that God has revealed himself in his Son, in Jesus' death and resurrection, that this happened, and so spirituality becomes something that is a human experience. Jesus taking up human flesh in the incarnation of the Son, we have a spiritualization of the here and the now. Christianity, you need to understand, Christianity is not an escapist religion. We believe in eternity. We believe that after we die, our souls go to be with God until we get a resurrected body. But our spirituality is carried out in the nitty-gritty of life, right here, right now. In this way, younger person, Christianity is not boring at all. Christianity is expressed in your work, in the locker room, on the sports field, in the classroom. For Christians, all of life is an expression of what we believe. So we carry that out in our daily life. Look at this. 1 Timothy 3:14 to 16. I write these things to you, hoping to come to you soon. But if I should be delayed, I've written so that you will know how people ought to act in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth. And most certainly the mystery of godliness is great. He was manifested in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen by angels, preached among the Gentiles, believed on in the world, taken up in glory. Christian spirituality is here and now and later. It's in our lives. It's where we are. It's our workplaces. It's our families. It's our jobs. And this household imagery that Paul establishes in chapter 3, verses 14 to 16, we have noticed is taken up in chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Paul directs Timothy of how he should treat older men like fathers, older women like mothers. He's talking about a household, a family. Younger women as sisters with all propriety, younger men as brothers, and then other subclasses within the broader congregation. Who is after these four groupings? Widows. And they are to be helped by the church if they have met certain criteria. And in so doing, they esteem the Christian message. I tried to establish that a couple of weeks ago, that in honoring widows who are truly widows, who have been faithful in their household, in their family, and in the broader community of the church, and exemplify Jesus Christ as a church helps them, they esteem that message. And it has greater influence, greater renown in the congregation and reverberating throughout. It's that same mindset that Paul takes into dealing with the next subclass, elders. And those who are ruling well, those who are doing a good job, as opposed to those who aren't, make sure the good ones are getting taken care of. Because they're needed in the church. Because what happens in the leader's life and what comes from the leader's mouth will affect the whole congregation in days to come. So make sure they're taken care of. Because if you take care of them, you're again esteeming the Christian message. There's a through line in Paul's paragraphs in chapters 5 to 6. It's about the Christian message. It's about the faith. It's about the truth. It's about the gospel. As you esteem that, there's greater influence. So use the resources to esteem that. And then we get to chapter 6, where we are at today. And I think with you about our attitude toward money as a measure of our spirituality. And for Paul, money is an instrument to be used in the faith. All, in Paul's mind, all resources that we would have are from God, and we are to steward them for God. He gives us richly everything to enjoy, we'll see later in chapter 6. And along the way, we need to use all that we can for influence of the Christian message, to esteem it. And we do that in our relationships, we do that in our habits, and so forth. I have to confess here today that this message, though it is important for our church because it is in 1 Timothy and we're going through the book, and if you're guests with us, that is how we operate. I want to be clear that in no way are we in going through this book or looking at this passage particularly today, are we concerned about trying to get more money from someone, or as if I'm preaching this today because the church isn't generous, or there's in no way is that the case. If you're a guest with us, you are in the midst of a group of very generous people. The people around you are spontaneously generous and strategically generous. When I recognize a need around MCC, I often see people beating me to it in terms of spontaneity, trying to help, trying to care, whether it's through an MCG or otherwise. I see strategic generosity, people taking radical steps, housing, vehicles, immediate kinds of needs, and strategizing of how they can do that. There's not much more practical that you can get in terms of generosity than housing and transportation, right? Healthcare as well. And so when I'm setting out this message, understand I'm not in any way confronting. I'm encouraging. But I have to recognize with you as well that Paul's language is pretty sharp here. What we're going to look at here in beginning verses 3 down through 10, his language is sharp. And we just need to let that set upon us, perhaps. Even though there's a history of generosity in terms of spontaneity and in terms of strategy, we need to think about what we're doing and why ourselves, and let this settle upon us nonetheless. One of the doctrines that is going to surface here is the doctrine, the biblical teaching about humanity and pride. And we'll unpack that along the way. So join me then. Here's our question. How is our attitude toward money a measure of our spirituality? A church demonstrates spiritual maturity as we esteem the faith. That's the goal all the way through chapters 5 and 6, esteeming the faith in the org chart of our employment. Where we're at, we esteem it there. And live contented, fruitful lives. That's Paul's wish and concern for the church in Ephesus. Join me then, verses 1 to 2. Notice how Paul writes about the org chart in principle. All who are under the yoke as slaves must regard their own masters to be worthy of all respect, so that God's name and his teaching will not be blasphemed. And those who have believing masters should not be disrespectful to them because they're brothers, but should serve them better, since those who benefit from their service are believers and dearly loved. Notice the statement at the end of verse 1. What is Paul ultimately concerned about? God's name and his teaching. This is what I've tried to develop in chapter 5 and into chapter 6. And how we work, how we carry out the objectives of our position in our org chart is an expression of God's glory, because we claim him and we claim the incarnation. God's spirit is in us. So this is an opportunity for us to go and esteem the Christian message. So this is another subclass of people, all who are in the yoke, employees, slaves. And that this brings to mind slavery in the ancient world, distinctions with slavery in the pre-Civil War era in the United States and even before that in Britain. In slavery, the enslavement of a specific ethnicity, people especially from West Africa, and bringing them to the United States to work and to make them simply machines, though human, for profit. That was not slavery in the ancient world. In the ancient world, slavery wasn't ethnic-based. It was finance-based, mainly. If someone was impoverished, they would sell themselves, and they could be mistreated, but they may have a great skill set. There were physicians who were slaves. There were farmers who were slaves, and many of them had an honorable position in the ancient world, entrusted with great oversight of resources that an owner would keep into their care to take care of for a profit. So there's a spectrum in the ancient world of slavery in terms of difficulty or ease or dishonor or honor. The slave didn't have rights and freedom, but that didn't mean slavery was always bad, as often we think of in the United States and in Britain, where slavery did have an ethnic oppressive overtone nearly across the board. It wasn't that way in the ancient world. There are principles in which we could say slavery in the ancient world did resemble employment to some degree here. There's some nuance, but generally speaking, we can make those kinds of connections. And Paul is concerned, verse 1, if you're a slave, respect your master. Why? Because God's name is at stake. And, verse 2, if your master is a believer, don't take advantage of the situation. My master's a Christian. Christians are supposed to be benevolent, kind. Oh, And Paul's gospel message is one of freedom, equality. Neither slave nor free. Paul says, no, that's not the way to think. The principle of pride in verses 1 to 2 that Paul is countering is libertine laziness. Libertine laziness. I'm free in Christ. You're free in Christ. We're equal. Not a slave. Libertine laziness. That is the first expression of pride of three that we'll see in our text. Libertine laziness. And Paul says no. Those who have believing masters should not, verse 2, be disrespected. You should not disrespect them because they are brothers. Why would you disrespect a brother? How is that ever going to help you? Unless you have a libertine mindset. Libertine laziness. I don't have to do that. I'm in. You're in. We're in the same way. There's neither slave nor free. Jew nor Greek. That's what Paul says. They're brothers, verse 2. You have an opportunity to help a brother. Serve them. Notice what Paul says in the second clause. Serve them better. If your boss is a believer, you have an opportunity to esteem the Christian message at multiple levels of the org chart. Not just on your own, but now you have an opportunity to show the whole organization how it works. And it does work in the nitty-gritty of life. It works here and now. Christianity isn't a great escapism. It's empowerment here. What a testimony you could make! Not usurping your boss, but because he's a believer, all the more. And those watching on the outside, serve them better. Because those who benefit from their service are believers and dearly beloved. And we understand in our day, if your boss is a believer and you're doing a good job and your boss makes more money because of you, what will ultimately happen to you? You will make more money. That's just the way it is. If this is a believing boss, you have a great opportunity here. Libertine laziness is an expression of pride. The other two expressions of pride we will see here follow in halfway through verse 2 and then through verse 10, where Paul calls us to live contented, fruitful lives. Notice the text. Teach and encourage these things. Now Paul, directly addressing Timothy in his leadership position, calls us back to the end of chapter 4, where again he's directly, this is what you should do, beginning of chapter 5, this is what you should do, teach these things. And he's, again, still dealing with the leaders in the church and those elders who are not teaching sound doctrine. Verse 3, if anyone teaches other doctrine and does not agree with the sound teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ and with the teaching that promotes godliness, I'm going to stop there before I go through verses 4 through 10. Verse 3, we don't want to just take these principles off the page and not recognize the flow of what Paul is getting at and Timothy's role here. In Timothy's situation, he is having to fix the leadership problem, get rid of those elders who are not teaching well, and make sure those who are established and taken care of so that this ministry can go on. Because as the leaders live and as they teach, the church will be affected in the next generation. So this is his concern. It's esteeming the Christian message. So he's setting out this idea about teaching because there are people who are teaching these different ideas, and some of them are teaching a kind of, it seems, mythology, a mix-up of Judaism and paganism, but that matrix that they are teaching has a here and now libertinism, it seems like, about it that is somewhat ascetic, and there's a self-denial involved in what Paul states in chapter 4 in the first paragraph, but here about greed. So this mashup of teaching that Paul is trying to deal with moves in different directions. It's kind of a false self-denial, and then also a sense of greed and pride now. To some things they're denying themselves, marriage, abstaining from certain foods. Other things are taking advantage of. Greed now, libertine greed. So this is what he is doing. And he's very strong in his language about needing to fix this teaching problem. And we'll get to why in just a moment. I just want to make sure we're clear on verse 3. There's an exact situation involved. So here's this false kind of teacher. Verse 4. This person who teaches that slaves should go on in libertine laziness, he's conceited, understanding nothing, but having a sick interest in disputes and arguments over words. Do you see what's happening here? I said it earlier. What we believe is worked out in our lives. The doctrine we heed determines our deeds. And that's true for orthodoxy, and it's true for heresy. So you, in some ways, you don't always need to ask what someone believes. You just watch their life for a while and work backward. Envy, quarreling, slander, suspicions, constant disagreement, verse 5, among men whose minds are depraved and deprived of the truth. They imagine that godliness is a way of material gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into the world. We can take nothing out. If we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. What's the opposite of that? Wanting to get rich, falling into temptation and trap, harmful desires, plunging people into ruin and destruction. The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. By craving it, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains. Verse 4, the person who acts this way is conceited. It's a conceited teacher who's teaching this. Hopefully it looks like material gain in their following as well. This idea of conceited in Paul's language, this is a state of their lives. They're in a state of conceit. That is who they are. They are proud. Well, this grouping of people, if we could allow the teachers to represent this whole grouping, this pride that has determined how they're living, this pride we've seen already is manifest in one way, a libertine laziness. The second is rebellious speech. Did you notice verses 4 and 5? Arguments over words. From these come envy, quarreling, slanders, evil suspicions, verse 5, constant disagreement. It's rebellious talk that is rooted in conceit. Rebellious talk, likely with regard to how we carry out our lives, and likely with this libertine edge to it. I'm not going to submit myself. We're free. I'm done with this slavery. I'm done with serving and looking out for someone else. It's someone who is taking Christianity and removing one slice and making that what they are all about. Freedom, and then defining that freedom, not as Paul defines it in Galatians 6, in terms of an opportunity, not for the flesh, but free to serve, free to love one another. Notice how different love is from arguments over words, quarreling, slanders. Do verses 4 and 5 describe a church you'd want to be a part of? Would you want to be a part of an org chart in your employment like that? You know that if you're in that kind of an org chart, and I've talked with some of you with your chat, how difficult life is. Now, there's a theology behind that, and it's a theology of greed and pride. You take away pride, and you will soon have a different speech environment wherever you're at. Workplace or church, doesn't matter. Family. It's rebellious speech. And third is this idea of greed. So conceit can be libertine laziness, verses 1 to 2. It can be rebellious speech, verses 3 to 4. Or it can be just flat-out greed, verses 5 and following. They imagine that greed is gain, but it's not. Godliness is gain, verse 5. Godliness with contentment, verse 6. Here's the phrase, we brought nothing into the world and we can take. The joke rings true, you never see a hearse pulling a trailer with a U-Haul. You can take nothing with you. And if our lives now are a desire to be rich, to fall into temptation and a trap is where we'll be. Verse 9, the desire for wealth plunges people. Notice the language. Ruin and destruction. Piercing, verse 10. Paul notes that greed brings trouble on the person who is greedy. Harming them, ruin, destruction, piercing with pains. Michael Gorman summarizes the passage in terms of teachers and with the congregation in view. This passage suspects that the false teachers have two problems, their doctrine and their motives. The explicit attention given to money in these concluding admonitions, together with the implicit concern voiced elsewhere, suggests that the accusation of greed is not merely polemical. This reminder is likely intended as both a criticism of certain teachers and a warning to all that underneath greed is pride, and that pride can lead to libertine laziness. It leads to rebellious speech, and it leads flat out to greed and a here and now mentality. Our spirituality is expressed in our workplace. It is a measure of our spirituality because it determines our thoughts about money. I want to set out five brief meditations for us as we walk away from this passage, and as Ryan picks up some of this same theme next week and again deals with money. These issues will surface again. We've seen them in chapter 5, and I've said these two chapters set these ideas out. Number one, somewhat of review, but these five will hang together here as well. Number one, the manner in which we fulfill our work obligations expresses our spirituality. To summarize it briefly, the manner of our work shows our belief. Paul writes about this at the end of Colossians 3 and the beginning of chapter 4. Do your work heartily unto the Lord, not for men, not for eye services, man, but sincerity of heart, fearing God. The Lord will reward you. It's the manner of our work, a manner of sincerity of heart. This employee who came to work for my mom, the atmosphere was different. The whole atmosphere. Simply by someone who's a part-time employee. Number two, one's love of money does not necessarily correlate with their level of wealth. This we need to keep in mind. It's so easy in our day to disparage those who are wealthy. If they seem to have a lot, the world says they must be greedy. They must be an oppressor. And if they don't have much, they must be noble in character. They must be upright. There's nothing that correlates there. You could have very little and be greedy to the core. you could be extremely impoverished and held captive by greed. You could be very wealthy and not love money. There's not a correlation there. How many of us have benefited from wealthy believers? Simply because they worked hard, God blessed them, and they had a lot, and they were willing to share. I'm not sure of a more difficult sphere of life that Paul deals with than being a wealthy Christian. Because you're falsely accused all over. You're constantly being asked for resources. And you have to manage a business likely that is funding it. Pray for wealthy Christians. Pray that God will help them to be content, be generous, to enjoy what God's given them, and to walk with Him. Number three, let your org chart be your prayer list. Let your org chart be your prayer list. Pray for your boss. Pray for your boss's boss. Pray for the owners. Pray for those who report to you. Pray for those who report to them. Let your organizational chart, if you work at home, let that be a prayer list for you. This person, this person, this person. If you work for a Fortune 100 company, let that be a prayer list. Why? Because your work is an expression of what you believe, and you don't want God's name blasphemed. And you have an opportunity to esteem it, especially if you have some believers working around you or your boss is a believer. Oh, the joy to get a new job and you find out your boss is a Christian. So go work harder and pray for them. Number four, remember God's providence, Matthew chapter 6. Don't worry about your life. God clothes the flowers of the field, and not even Solomon in all his glory was clothed like one of them. Don't be anxious. God will care for you. As you toil, you trust. As you labor, you lean on God. This is about you, God. I could work all day, but I'm trusting you. It's God's providence. And finally, an admonition I've stated before, plan your funeral. Plan your funeral will help you think about dying, that you can't take any. You brought nothing in, nothing's going with you. Doesn't matter what we have. But also, plan your will. There are so many churches, so many Christian institutions who have benefited from, sadly, people passing and the sadness of that. But because of resources that are accumulated along the way, they have been able to invest in a church, in an institution, and bless that. And in that person's passing, so much has been done. Plan that. Get it organized. Be strategic now. When my father passed, and I was sitting with my mother and planning things out, and insurance money had come in, and I said, "You, Mom, you have a chance now to do something you've never been able to do. Never. You're never going to have this chance again. Let's do this." Strategic generosity. Would you pray with me? Lord, we're mindful of what you have done in Jesus Christ and the expression of spirituality now. Let us walk in that. Let us be people who practice our faith. We ask this in your Son's name.